Have you ever wondered what happened to the legendary Chuck Norris? I recently saw a health video he made and I was surprised. He's in his 80s and still seems to have his energy and health. He says he's even stronger, has more stamina, and plenty of energy left over for his grandkids since making one simple health change that helps his digestion and nutrition. He says he still feels like he's in his 50s. His wife made the same change and she's never felt better. She says she feels 10 years younger, and she has energy all day. Many of us do not include the fruits, vegetables, and other herbs that increase health and energy in our own diets. Chuck Norris made a special video that explains how he incorporated these things with one simple product. You can watch it by going to mymorningkick.com/Harris. It may change your approach to your own health. Once again, that's mymorningkick.com/Harris. Welcome once again to the Conversations That Matter podcast. I'm your host, John Harris, for an intellectually stimulating discussion today and an interesting discussion and an applicable discussion with a first-time guest. We have with us Kryptos. Kryptos, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, John. Thanks for having me on.
So, now, that's not your real name.
No, it is not. No, and actually, my wife was making fun of it for me yesterday, so she was like laughing at... I think I could probably do a whole podcast episode of just pulling up my follows and mentions and just letting my wife make fun of us all for our online names.
So, yeah, some people, I should probably just get this out of the way. Some people might be confused by this. I've never had an anon or an anonymous person who wishes to remain anonymous on the podcast before. And so people can look at, they can find your Substack, Seeking Hidden Thing. Is it seekinghiddenthing.com?
Seekingthehiddenthing.com.
Seekingthehiddenthing.com. Yeah. Seekingthehiddenthing.com. And they can go to @_Kryptos on X, formerly Twitter, but they will not find out exactly who you are. And I know that that alone is a little bit controversial now, I guess, on X, like pseudonymous accounts. So I'll just give you the floor on why you wish to remain anonymous. I think it's fairly obvious and defensible, but what's the reason for you?
There's actually two reasons. One is it's interesting because when I write pieces on my Substack, I also record them. And so I didn't always, and one of my subscribers suggested that I do that because I tend to write long pieces. And he said, hey, I don't have time to read this, but if you don't mind recording it, then I can listen to it in the car on the way to work. And thought, well, that's a really good idea, because that's kind of what Charles Haywood does with his book reports or his book reviews, right? He records them. And that's how I interacted with his material as well. I thought it was a great idea. So I've been going back and recording some of my old articles. And I just did one on Carl Schmitt, The Crisis of Parliamentary Democracy. So for me, on a personal level, I do it in part because this is what my wife asked me to do. And it's also smart. I live in the frozen north. And they don't, political speech is one thing. And I also have a business so that, that's what actually pays the bills. And I have a diverse clientele of people of different political persuasions. And there is an open question of whether, my political views, I don't generally talk politics with my clients. So there's a question if, somebody decided to out me and my political views became wide known, would that like detrimentally impact my ability to provide for my family? So that's on the one sort of practical level. So, honoring my wife's wishes and just, being practical about it. There may come a time where I can do this for a living and it's not a worry about having my name out there. But it's interesting. Carl Schmitt made the observation that speech is always drawn to power. So he says that the majority will always pressure the minority into bending their opinion to harmonize with the majority. And he says, you may disagree that you actually have free speech. He says, but you don't. He says, and the sign that you don't is that your vote is a secret vote. He says, if you really had free speech, he says, your vote would be open. But he says, that that's a lie because that if your vote was open, somebody would be pressuring you to vote in the correct way. And according to power and the majority, you would be pressured to vote for the majority. So to maintain the authenticity of your vote and to secure your own opinion about the vote, you do it in secret. And so in that regard, the only opinion that can be thought of as being truly free from the demands of power, and even then there is some question, is truly an anonymous opinion. And the founders basically felt the same way too. I mean, you look at most of the early dialogue with the founders was all done anonymously in yeah. op-eds. And now some people knew who the various names were, but it wasn't, it didn't necessarily have to be that way. But they wrote pseudonymously, in part for that very reason, because the kind of things that they were saying were dangerous. And yes. and then they would fall victim to the pressures of power to conform to the majority. And so that's Carl Schmitt's observation about he was making observations about the contradictions within democracy in terms of, you know, democracy being built on the foundation of an open public debate. And he just basically says, well, it's just an illusion. He says, it's not really the case because power always tries to conform the minority to the majority opinion. So there you go. That's kind of that's the brief defense of why anonymity is a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're not here to talk about this subject, but I will say for people who might be new to the podcast, I've told this many times before on the podcast, but I actually used a pseudonymous name years ago write a book. And I was actually warned by people that I respected. I was just going to put my name on it. And they said, you better not do that. Like, if you want a job in academia, then this could threaten that. And so I used the name Joseph J. You can go check out the book. I'm trying to remember the name of it now. Sacred Conviction, The South's, I think, Fight for Biblical Authority is the subtitle. Anyway, I mean, you can already tell from the title that that's probably a book that would get you canceled in certain settings. And anyway, I'm the worst at using pseudonyms. I just, like, you know, then I went to like my personal Facebook. I'm like, everyone should get this book that I didn't just write. No. And so there were some people years later who thought they had doxed me and all this stuff. And I'm like, well, I kind of already like put enough out there. I kind of doxed myself.
Yeah.
And that's the difficulty with this, is that in a time when telling the truth is that you could be punished for it. And you know, it's a threat to your livelihood of your family, then you kind of have this catch 22 where if you're someone who, let's say years ago, probably someone like yourself, and I know many others would have been part of the ruling class or the influential class in this country, you would have a job perhaps at a university or a seminary, and the people, the smart guys, like on our side, or I should say more conservative side, like, they actually can't get jobs. Like, and if they do, they have to be muzzled. And if they decide not to be muzzled, it threatens their family. And if they decide to go pseudonymous, how do they advertise what they're saying so people know? So it's like this whole thing. But so anyway, I empathize with it. I understand. And I've been interacting, or at least reading some of your stuff for, I don't know, I think I've known about you for at least like a year or two.
Yeah, I've been doing this since, I think, 2021. So, but yeah.
That probably is accurate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I think Jay Burden and there's some other guys, I know you're sort of in a network, and I've listened to just like where you've been interviewed on other shows. I think that's mainly sure. where I started hearing you. So anyway, we're going to have our own show here and talk about stuff yeah. that you've talked about before. And it's, I heard the Chronicles podcast where you talked about this. I don't know if you've said anything about it in other places, but we're going to talk about the technological society and really, like, big picture here. What I want to do for people who are listening is I want to take a bird's eye view of one aspect of modernity. That is the increase in technology. We're using technology right now. You're using it. I'm using it. People who are listening to this are using technology. And we just take it for granted. It doesn't even occur to us sometimes, like, how different the world was before. Like, even if you watch a movie from the 1980s, let's say, and you just notice that, like, hey, you couldn't do instant communication. You had to call the restaurant someone was at if you wanted to try to track them down, if you needed to get a hold of them. I mean, there's so many things that have changed even in a period of 40 years that are just, that are huge. And forget about going back 100 years or 200 years. So, you know, what has this done to us? What should we be careful about? And Jacques Ellul was one of the critics,
We'll talk about him a bit, of the technological society, James Burnham with the managerial revolution as well. And so I'm going to just kind of let you take it away in any direction you want. But first question here, I guess I'll put it this way. What is technology when we talk about that?
Okay, that's good that you asked that, because I think that was probably the way that I was going to go for your audience too. The hardest thing for, I think, people to, that there's two main things that if people want to take away from this. The first is that technology, or the technological society, and technique is the word that Alul uses, because there's a continuum that you move from tool using, and Alul would argue that we're a tool using species as human beings. So we use tools, but there's a difference between the way that we used to use tools and our interaction with tools today. And what Alul argues is that technique and the technological society is less about the actual tools than it is about a way of thinking about the world. And he says that this way of thinking in the technological society, and that's part of the transformation from being tool-using people to living in a technological society, is that all solutions to every problem become technical. There is really only one answer allowed. Now, you might have variations within that, but all the solutions for every problem become some manner of technical solution. And it is the dominant way of thinking about everything, every problem. And if you might say, it's the dominant ideology of our age, and that is technique. And so people don't really think about it, but that's really what binds, when you talk about the uniparty, the unifying state. Why is it that is business woke? Why are the churches going woke and all these types of things? Well, it's because they all run on the same basic operating system. They are all think the same way fundamentally. And you might argue that, oh, our conservative religious leaders don't, but they do, right? If you run a mega church, you're a technician. And that's just the bottom line, right? And so, and fundamentally, technique is part of the whole movement and mindset of progressivism. And so the technique is what gives progressivism its impetus and its legs. So that's the first part, is to say that technology is a way of thinking about the world. And that's the first thing, I think, if your people can, and we can maybe dive deeper into that. And then the second thing that we would have to, I think, that's important to come away with, if you don't come away with anything else, is to change how you think of technique and technology. And we can get more into like what exactly is a technique, but to understand that technique and technology is neither good nor bad nor neutral. Technique is ambivalent. It does not care. And so you have to understand that technique, every technology that gets introduced, every quote unquote solution to a problem that is a technical solution will come with good things, and it will come with bad things, like ills, that negative impacts, and the two always come together. So whatever gains or benefits you get from technology will come with a certain price to be paid. There are certain ill effects that will come with it, and they both come together, and there's nothing you can do about it. You cannot plan ahead of time, because certain effects will be unknown, and generally the benefits are front-loaded, and the ills that result come later, after most of the benefits have been accrued. And so what Alul argues is that you have to understand that the introduction of a technique or technology will have effects regardless. So it doesn't matter. You could say, well, like, for example, the favorite example is one of a gun, right? Well, what really matters, a gun is neutral. It's just like a lump of metal in your hand. What really matters is how you use it. And Alul would say that's absolutely incorrect. Right? He would argue that that gun has a certain purpose, and that purpose is to fire projectiles at a high velocity. Well, those high velocity projectiles, they will do good things. You can use them to protect, but those high velocity projectiles will also be used to do ill. And those two come together, and it does not matter. Now, would you prefer that we use them for better things? Yes. but you are never going to escape the ills that come from the introduction of firearms into a society. It just, you can't do it. There is nothing you can do to prevent the ills from coming into. The only thing that Ellul argues in the end that you can do, and he says you can't introduce new technologies to protect against the old technologies because those new technologies come with their own sets of goods and ills. The only thing you can ultimately do is to apply to subordinate the technology morally and just simply say no. But the problem with technology is that it's very powerful. So people introduce them and use them because they allow you to manipulate reality successfully, both immaterial reality, like human, like populations, but they also are very, very good at making people money. And so as a result, you can say, well, we're going to, you know, subordinate these technologies. We're going to say no, but somebody will say, hey, well, you know, why did everybody say no to that? I can use this thing to gain power. Everybody else said no to guns. I'm going to like, yeah, let's use these guns and we can rule the world and make a bucket load of money. And that's one of the fundamental problems that you have with technology is that, and this is really what allowed the technological world to happen, is that it overcame the religious restraints, largely through Christendom, the religious restraints that held back technological development. And that was part of the man, like the merchant classes pushing through and overthrowing the old order of nobility and the church towards the making of money, the pursuit of knowledge, and the introduction of technique. And then once you've done that and you've shaken off those moral restraints, it just basically allows it to go on without restraint. And so now basically every problem is a technical problem. That's a lot of words to say it, but that's kind of, so those are your two big ideas, that technology is a way of thinking, and technology doesn't care.
Could you give an example, like for someone who has a middle class corporate job, and like just paint the picture of their life from start to finish, right? They get up, they go to work. When they're at work, they, you know, they're a manager in some factory or you know, they're an engineer or whatever. And then they come home, and then there's diversion to try to kind of,
yeah,
distract them from the problems technology has brought up. Just to make it very concrete for people who actually, yeah, live this life, many middle class Americans do, in the suburbs especially, so that they know that that's not the way humans have always lived, and that's still in some ways not exactly the way people live in more rural environments.
No, so probably the best way to do this is to draw a contrast between the older way of using tools and way of living and the new way of the technical system. So let's go back to a pre-industrial world. Okay. You're a lord, you have an estate, you have all these different functions. Let's take, for example, this is the one I commonly use. You have a stable of animals. You've got your horses for your knights. You've got probably some grazing animals and so forth. And you have a staff of people in charge of them, right? At the top of that, you would have the stable master. Now, he's probably not a nobility, or if he is, he'll be a minor noble. But this stable master is somebody who would have grown up in the stable. So he begins as a stable boy, maybe as a squire to a knight. He learns to handle the animals, to love the animals. But a lot of this knowledge is being passed on to him apprentice style. So it's all part of memory. It's just the way things. And so one person's memory, the cultural memory of the stable, sort of there's rules, but sort of this is how we do things. This is how we don't do things. And over time, he interiorizes these rules and he interiorizes the way of doing it. He learns how to care for the animals. He learns how to do it. And you could talk about this in a shop as an apprentice. He learns how to make, you know, chairs, or he learns how to forge iron and all these types of things. So they're learning it intuitively. They're learning it. They're being shown how to do it. It's all embedded knowledge. It's all organic. Eventually what happens is that, you know, maybe the old stable master dies. And this guy has kind of risen up, and then he's placed in charge. Now this person is actually in charge, and he's now bears personal responsibility, but he's learned everything that needs to be known about the stables from the ground up organically. He's soaked in the culture, and this is the way that they manage the stable. So he then if something goes wrong with the animals, right, say a number of horses die and it's inexplicable, he bears personal responsibility. The Lord holds him accountable. Maybe he loses his position. His family is ruined. Maybe he even loses his life, you know, because of that. He bears personal responsibility for this. And so in the older way, what was decisive was not the tool, but the skill of the craftsman. So you used a handful of tools and you used them in a variety of settings. And what made the tools work was not the tool itself, but was the skill of the craftsman. And you could talk about it in terms of rules for, like, say, laws of a society. So you might have a social grouping. Let's say there's a number of rules and patterns within the stable, and you might write them down of these are the laws of the stable, but those rules are merely a shorthand for what everybody knows intuitively anyways in a society. But it's just kind of, and this is kind of the way that, say, the Ten Commandments function. They function in a cultural setting where everybody knows. So you have a small number of rules that get applied over a wide variety of situations. And the decisive thing is not the rule, but the wisdom of the person who understands the culture, understands the situation, and then knows how to properly apply the rule, much like you would use a tool. So that's kind of your relationship between all of your basic sort of social tools in an organic setting. Now then, what happens is in the transition, so we picture like a hard transition. So the Lord, you know, calls up McKinsey and Company, send in a bunch of consultants, right? And what they do, and this is kind of the Taylorism, the time and motion studies, they come into the stables, right? They examine everything from top to bottom, every process, everything, the way that it's all done. And they come up then with a whole management plan, a set of policies and procedures for the working of the stable. So what they've done is they take this organic thing that lives in the lives of the stable hands, the stable master, and the whole culture of the stable, and they abstract it and rationalize it and turn it into a set of policies and plans. Now, if you want to discuss, if you want to improve things in the stable, you don't even need the stable. You can go and have a meeting in a cabin room. You don't even have to necessarily even be a stable master. You can take all your information back to the offices in the city, and you can sit around with your consulting team, and you can try to improve the processes of the stable. And then once you've refined them, you can then transport these to other stables and implement. So what happens is now is no longer that the culture and the people in there, the decisive thing. The decisive thing becomes the plan, the abstracted set of policies and the rationale there. So, but once you've also abstracted, now you can also do things like you can apply machines to the running of the stable. So we think, okay, well, let's add a computer system in here to make sure that the feeding is more efficient for the animals. And so you introduce this idea of efficiency. You're looking for predictable outcomes. You're looking to elevate the floor. So now you can hire people who maybe are not quite as competent, but you can hire more. So you can expand it on scale because you can take people that are less competent and you can elevate them through training, through processes, and you can do it the Walmart way or you know what I mean? And so then you can implement this policy. So what happens is that the important thing becomes the training, the disciple, or the policies, the procedures, the equipment, the machines. And the person is just really a fungible cog that can be swapped in and out as long as they can be trained into it. And then so you get like managers in offices, and really a manager is most often just a collection of policies and procedures. So if there's something going wrong in the office, he goes away for training. They bring in consultants, or a lot of times even the process of improvement, you know, this idea of constant improvement is part of it all. So where, you know, if there's something wrong, we bring in the consultants, we improve it, recycle it back. And what often ends up happening is that the process of improvement becomes even more important than the results. And so you hear this in meetings all the time. It's important that we have good process in the meeting. You know, and you think like, well, okay, but maybe the whole process is a completely you-know-what show, but as long as we got good results, hey, that's a good thing. But the technical mindset doesn't think that way. They're worried about as long as the process is good, the result will take care of itself. So that's kind of your shift in mindset. Everything becomes abstracted. Everything becomes rationalized. It becomes portable. It becomes turned into, sort of objective written policies that then transcend, and basically you don't really need. And you can see this in places like teaching, for example, like teaching. You no longer are dependent upon the skill of the teacher. You just basically bring anyone of a certain minimum of intelligence in, and you teach them all the methodologies, and then you will produce consistent result, education results on the other end. And so the real important things becomes not so much the quality of the person of the teacher, but the discussion becomes about what methods should we use to teach the kids. Does that difference then make sense to you?
Yeah. And if I could get your opinion on as to whether this applies, I think for this audience, especially to more in an ecclesiastical situation. So like I've actually had a weird kind of seminary experience. I went to three different seminaries. And most of my credits came from Southeastern, and that's where I graduated from. But I did a semester at the Master Seminary. I did a bunch of Liberty Online stuff, and I did an in-person course there. And if I had to sum up kind of like based on what you just said, like kind of like what the graduate from those seminaries, because they're all a little different. There's things that obviously are the same about them, but they have their spin on things. Like, what would they do when they got into a church? Like, you've been to the pastor factory, really, which is kind of how we treat seminaries. And if you went to like TMS, and I'm gonna try to do this so people don't get too offended. I've appreciated.
You know what? Don't be offended, because the seminary that I went to, it's much the same, and the approach is fairly similar. So
if you went to like. Yeah, I don't know which one you went to. Maybe you'll blow your cover if you say, but
I probably shouldn't.
But if I went to, TMS my whole time, I'm going to come out of TMS probably going into a church thinking like, I'm going to be biblical. Like, that would be the highlighted word. This is going to be biblical. And you know what's part of being biblical? Elders and a plurality of them. And it's going to be reformed in soteriology, and it's going to be premillennial in its eschatology, and so there's sort of this like there's this list, you might be able to add other things to it here and there, and there's certainly hidden things you don't realize that you pick up at these places, but you have your what I think you just described as like the process, the procedure, it's like the factory setting, right? And then you go into some podunk town that's nothing like Grace Community Church, because Grace Community Church is a huge mega church that it's attached to the seminary. And you try to like implement these policies, and it doesn't necessarily, it's not always suited. It's not always, it doesn't always work. And the timing of it doesn't always work if you try to do it too quickly. So if you think, you know, this is just biblical, right? If I went to SCBTS, which is where I graduated from, you know, you're going to go into a church thinking like, we're going to implement the Great Commission stuff here, which means we're going to have a diverse congregation. It's going to look like Revelation. And so you start changing policies to match that. Or if you're from Liberty, you know, it's more of like it's more broad, but it's probably like based on individual experience and personal relationship with Christ. And so you're going to go into a church and you're going to try to change the settings of that church to conform to the factory settings that you were taught, right? And so I think people can relate to that, because there's been, especially since 2020, I would say a lot of people have realized that as younger pastors, as the boomer generation is retiring, are coming in wanting not to be like the stable master you just described, who spent a long time really just learning the ways of the traditions of that particular stable and taking personal responsibility. They're coming in as technicians. Is that a fair parallel?
Yeah, it's actually probably worse than that. Than what you, right, I mean, well, we can really drop a black pill on your audience, but maybe this is the place to do it.
You can do it. Yeah, okay. Go for it.
Okay, so that, and I will get into trouble for saying this. You know, things like systematic theology can be wonderful, right? And this is the thing about the policies and so forth of the technical regime. They are powerful. And that you and this is the thing that Alul, you have to realize, is that because you can't say they're good or they're evil, they bring benefits, right? So that you have to remember that all of these techniques bring benefits. But if you want to do the long and short of it, this idea that we have of systematic theology, okay, think about what we just described with the stable, right? So you take scripture which is a living collection of stories and poems and letters and so forth. And you're going to abstract it and rationalize it. Well, what have we done? We've basically taken systematic theology is basically sending in the McKinsey consultants in to have a look at the Bible and develop. And now you can talk about the Bible without ever having to actually open the Bible, because you can talk about the theology as an abstraction separate from the scriptures itself, or even from the actual direct theophany that it underlies the scriptures, right? So you can make the case, and I've gotten into trouble for people just that, like, they really react badly when you say that. So there's, on the one hand, where for all the benefits of systematic theology, that systematic theology is like a policy manual for the Bible. So it's a form of the same kind of technologizing of the scriptures. It just, it is, and this is one of the things that Alul says. He says, I'm not trying to be necessarily critical. I just want you to see how deep the rabbit hole goes, okay? So then there's the other thing in terms of how we interpret. And this is how I was taught how to do interpret. So you use quote unquote critical methods. You're given a methodology hermeneutically. You follow these basic steps in terms of, you know, do the original language, do the historical study, do the form critical studies, do all of the various studies. And then when all of that is done, you will come up with the big idea of the text that then you can then transport into the future, and then we can apply that to the new setting, right? Well, that's basically a technical approach. You become a technician of the word. And most of us in our seminaries are taught to be technicians of the word in one degree or another. There's very few that learn how to do mystical interpretation of the scripture or allegorical interpretation of the scripture. They just don't.
Can I stop you right there? And I want you to continue. Sure. I know there's like all sorts of red like lights going off and warning signs, people listening right now.
Oh, yeah.
And I just want to say that. I think the expository, what you're describing sounds to me like the sort of the expository preaching, or it could at least fit the expository preaching kind of brand, where you do become this grammar expert who just talks about the relationships
of the word.
Yeah, like here's what the nouns and the verbs and their relationship, and you don't. I've even heard people go to the extreme of saying like you shouldn't even apply the word, like you should it to the setting. I mean, you're talking about an application, I mean, it's so narrow that it's just like I become, an English, someone who can explain what the Greek says to you in English. So anyway, carry on.
Yeah. So then on the other level is the whole thing of running churches, right? So, you know, you take the Great Commission. Well, we need the church to grow. We want to bring in the unchurched. And so then a lot of the focus in our technological society becomes on what's the proper methodology for church growth. So, you know, you've got your various different types of models. You've got the seeker model, you've got the small church model, or the small group model. So you have all these different models, and you're growing the church, but you're doing so using technical methods. Now, what's interesting in a sense of this way is that most people who go through the seminary process, by the time you get to seminary, you're working on your master's degree. So who are your peers? Well, your peers are other people with master's degrees or beyond, right? So it's your lawyers, it's your doctors, it's, you know, it's professors. Your peers are the expert class. And so your pastors come in, and they're basically, their ethos is this kind of professionalism that's built on smart policy, technical management. They're taught to be, in many places, technicians of the word. They're taught a technical approach to understanding the script, or understanding scripture and theology in a systematic approach and an abstract and rational approach to understanding the scriptures. So they bring this basically in. And a lot of it you'll see, like, especially in this dynamic now, you're getting in like the Southern Baptist congregations and so forth, and others, where you have many prominent members who are advocating, well, what we really need to do is just put this woke away and then allow the church to go back to normal. And what they're basically saying is that we've got to put the crazies away so we can go back to a kind of technical management of the church, to this sort of technocracy, this church's technocracy. And what people don't realize is that by and large, our churches have in many ways already capitulated to the fundamental operating system of the regime. They just do so with a language of Bible, scripture, and theology. But fundamentally, at a basic level, many of our leaders are essentially experts and technicians. They're part of the technical classes in that regard. And so this is one of the challenges that we face. Really the question is like, what do you do about it in response? This is kind of where your $600 question comes in, is sort of what do we do with in response? But this is kind of where we're at in a society. And a lot of it we've done it for, we thought we're really good. So, you know, in terms of the country, what we do to secure our liberty. So we invited the managerial system in terms of to secure our liberty, or we're doing it to grow churches, or we're doing it to advance medical science, or we're doing it to enhance our business. And so we invite these technical means in, but now we've basically got across society more or less one solution, which is a technical solution. Everything involves a set of like, well, what's the plan? What's our policies? What do we need to do? We need to study this. We need to have some seminars on this. We need to bring in an expert. And everything revolves around this kind of technical way of thinking. And there's no other really solution allowed. Now, thankfully, within the church, there are still other solutions embedded. And some of those, like you talked about mentioning, like focusing on community, on the mystical relationship with prayer, on, you know, because we can still say, let's pray and wait on the Lord. Whereas in like a university or a government situation or a corporate life, you can't in a corporate boardroom, let's just sit around and pray and wait on the Lord. In the churches, you still have the hope that there's something there that we can grab onto that is authentically organic and rooted in a way that offers a solution that's different from the regime solution. And this is many ways why churches are increasingly under the microscope and targeted, is because we offer a real solution. Sort of concrete communities who are organically formed, who are then rooted in a real spiritual reality. And although it's been stressed by the technocracy, it hasn't been entirely erased. So there is still that foundation there. Even your technical pastor will still get on his knees and pray most of the time.
So, all right. So now everyone thinks you're Eastern Orthodox.
Yeah. Anyways,
I'm serious. Like what background do you come from?
I'm Reformed. So I'm Calvinist, but Reformed. So,
okay, I got you.
But I was blessed with having in my undergraduate years, a professor who was deeply immersed in Orthodox theology. And so, I'm Reformed with a fair degree of openness and coloring just I've been formed, by a lot of the wisdom of the Orthodox tradition. Like, for example, we often talk about the head-heart split. That's what people like, you know, it can't be all in your head. It's got to be in your heart. Which from my mind, it's just nonsense, right? Because then you basically put yourself at your mercy of your emotions. And that's more or less, that's just quick suicide for erasing any kind of moral fabric within the church. Right. So the real alternative, and this is one of the things that happened, one of the downsides of the good things that came with the Reformation, is that we got rid of the monasteries and we got rid of superstition. But in the process, we generally tossed out this idea of the mystical pursuit of union with God, the direct encounter with God. And although we talk about having a personal relationship with Jesus, we really don't talk about the encounter. There's not really a theology built around the encounter with God the way there is, say, in the Eastern Church. For example, we think of theology, theos and logos, as words about God, right? Because word and God. Whereas in the Orthodox tradition, they will talk about theology as words with or to God. So prayer and worship are theology. And so for me, what I argue is a sense of that we need to, rather than the head-heart split, it's good to have a strong passion for God. But what in my sense of what's needed to counter the technocracy of the churches today is a re-encounter, a direct encounter with God, in a sense, that mystical encounter with God himself. So in a sense, stop struggling, even though the theological questions are good questions, that ultimately in the end, even what you think you know about God, God is really beyond your knowing. But God can be, he can't be known, but he can be met, much in the way that we as persons can be met, but not fully known. And it's more of an intuitive thing that you can, like, I can see you eye to eye. I can get a sense of who you are in yourself, but to ultimately say, well, what is it that makes John who he is? You really can't put that in words because it's unique to who John is. And there's something about that in the relationship with God, that God can be right. met, but not truly known.
And I think to regard. Put it, that's a good example to use, to put it in a personal setting, the technicians would want to come up with like an abstract list of things that would perhaps distill some of, you know, like they would reflect some of the things that I am, like, oh, he's 6'1" and he has blue eyes, and he, like, they would get some things right, but then you couldn't like take the list and say, well, that's John. Like that's obviously, that's not
that's right.
a full picture. And that's not the essence of who I am. It is deeper. It is more, mystical is the word you use, but it's definitely like beyond.
Intuitive might be another word that people
it transcends the abstract yeah. categories and, that we can come up with. And so, so anyway, like to make this practical for people who are listening, and maybe some of them are freaking out, yeah. I don't know, but,
who knows? Yeah.
Well, it doesn't matter, but I'm only acknowledging them to say, like, hey, there's more coming, and we're going to try to explain this better, and or not better, but more.
We'll try to land this plane at some point.
No, we'll go deeper into it, and then give you some applications for, like, what does this actually mean to my life personally? You're obviously not saying that theology isn't important, that we should ditch theology or like
no, systematic exactly.
Right. So I think what you're saying is that technology.
Just recognize what it is, though.
Right. Technology comes with blessings and curses, essentially.
That's
and
right.
So, like, we have to be aware that this will affect us. I know when you were with CJ, you were talking about a television, and you were saying, like, so, like,
that's
whether
right.
it's, I think you were saying whether it's pornography or whether it's something that's wholesome, like, you'll be watching Little House on the Prairie, it's still yeah. mediated through this technology, the screen, and there's blessings and curses with that particular thing. And obviously, objectively speaking, there's a, like, we would, you know, reject pornography and embrace something that's more wholesome with inspirational things. But there is like a curse attached to even that wholesome. So I thought that was like a really good concrete explanation that sort of yeah. made it make sense for me. If you want to expand on that.
Well, this is a thing. Now, this is, again, we're getting away. So this is kind of why, you know, Elul's not the only thinker on technology. This comes from Marshall McLuhan. Which is a really, really good insight. And so once you take Elul's idea of technology as being ambivalent, it doesn't care, and then you add to it McLuhan's insight that the medium is the message, right? And so what
right.
McLuhan argues is that the important thing about technology is not the content. So we generally think of technology, again, this is that idea of technology as neutral, is that technology is kind of an empty vessel that we then fill with our moral content, right? So if you think of a system, like a government system, a bureaucracy, is fundamentally a technology. So we'll set that aside. Now, so what we mean by the medium is the message. So the fact of the television is more important than any one single show that you might show on the television. Now, again, we say, you know, good quality programming is better than lousy program, you know, wholesome programming is better than pornography, but you're in the end, just the fact that you're using the technology will shape you in ways that the television wants to shape you. Its own tells. So you'll end up with a 3-second attention span. You'll end up being a couch potato. All of these types of things. The effects of the television will happen regardless of the programming. We think another example might be the automobile. The fact of the mobility of the automobile is more important than any one particular trip that you might take. Right. So, and again, the fact of Twitter, for example, and its impact is more important than any one particular tweet that gets sent through Twitter. Okay. The fact of YouTube is more important than any one single video that gets put up onto YouTube. I think that makes the point. So here, when we come to our governing institutions, right, the fact of, say for like local stay at home for church, the fact of a seeker church and what we might call outreach technologies is more important, right, than anything that's put into them. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the very implementation of a seeker church changes you and your use of that technology. Now, when it comes to government and you're using the administrative state, and here's the thing that people really struggle with sometimes, it doesn't matter what the content is, because the administrative state will be the administrative state. And the administrative state is generally aligned with the ethos of technology, which is in itself has this kind of progressive impulse of constant improvement, constantly making things better, and so forth. So it really doesn't matter whether you have a Republican or a Democrat, as long as you use the administrative state, all policies, all technical policies are technical policies. And I know that seems like things. So what you have is that you are not using, say, you don't use the example, like you could run a government by having, say, 10,000 stables that are all run organically. The guy in charge is the guy in charge, and they're all run a little bit differently. They're all run in their own ways, and they all grow up, you know, that type of thing from within, and they all raise it by culture, but that's not how we run it. It's all top down. It's inorganic. It's imposed. The systems are imposed upon people to create uniformity, consistency, and so forth. So it doesn't matter whether you have Republican policies or Democratic policies. All of them are technical policies. The content is largely irrelevant. Now, would you rather have, in a sense, the difference between watching wholesome programming or pornography? Probably on the balance, it's better to have wholesome, you know. So maybe on the balance, it might be better, slightly better to have Republican policies than it has Democrat policies. But you're still being run by a totalitarian administrative state that wants to impose itself onto all of life and impose the technical way of thinking onto everything. That all solutions are technical solutions, then that all solutions can be solved if we just apply the right technical means to address them. So there isn't, and that's really where, you know, whether that problem is poverty, inequality, whether it's racism, whether it's low test scores, whatever the problem is, we can find a technical solution and we can apply it. And whether that problem is liberal policies, well, then we come up with conservative policies to address the liberal policies. And really, your only solution now becomes to have one policy replace another policy, but you're still using policies. It's still abstract, and it's basically the same thing.
And I know I keep bringing it back to the church, which I'm not like.
No, it's fine.
Just because of the audience and what we often talk about on this. But I see the same thing, this dynamic you're describing, playing out with the reaction to the woke movement in more conservative settings. There was this impulse to like blame it all on pragmatism, to try to find like sort of like one ism that it all can be summed up with. And then to just say, well, we just reject that. Like we'll just reject,
and everything will be fine.
If we just reject pragmatism, you know, then the church will get like, and different people, it's funny because I was deep in like researching it. Different sort of conservative groups had different, like they blamed different things and had different solutions for what they needed to cast overboard so that the ship would stop leaking. And I don't know that any of them actually have like are permanent solutions to what they're describing. Like, and I think part of the proof of that is like, you know, many of the big conferences and churches and so forth that blamed pragmatism. For wokeness. Now, if you look at, you know, what they're doing, they're involved in this political fight, you know, concerning quote unquote Christian nationalism, and they're implementing a lot of the same exact, like you called it programming, but it's like the same exact programming that was used by the woke advocates. They're using it now against Christian nationalists. And it's like, wait a minute. Like I thought, so the programming like wasn't really dumped.
No,
it was just, yeah, it was like rearranging chairs and like, so,
all so solutions anyway, are solutions.
Right. And so I guess there's two questions I have. One is, are there technologies that we as humans just genuinely cannot handle? We can't be responsible with it. We're always going to, it's going to bring out, like the cost is too high because it's going to do things to us that are just bad. And then with the current technologies that we're all using, you and I are using technologies right now to speak
absolutely
to each other
right now.
How do we manage or hand manage might not, you see, even I'm using a technical word here.
And that's, it's just, it's the way that we, yeah,
that's the way we're wired. Right.
That's exactly the way. And that's just kind of recognizing it. It's just sort of, you have to sort of see it before you can begin to really the scope of the problem.
How do we live with it? Right.
And how do we live? And that is so. Part of the problem. So here's the question, right? We hinted at this earlier, and this is what I've come to call the quote unquote, the tank problem. Right. So you could, as a society, say, we think that this certain level of technology is evil and terrible. We're going to get rid of it all, go back to like the pre-industrial 1700s society, like the Amish, but everybody. We're just going to, that's how we're going to just live life. And I suppose that's an option, right? You could do that. But you need to know that your neighbor next door has an industrial society with assembly lines that produce tanks. And you may think like, okay, we're going to live in the 1700s and be pre-industrial or whatever, but it won't take him long to realize like, oh, our neighbors have deindustrialized and they don't have any weapons anymore. We're just going to roll over them with our tanks. And so to maintain your sovereignty, you're now faced with a question. You have to figure out a way to deal with your neighbor's tanks. And so you may not have any choice in the matter, but to be technological. And this is the thing that Alul says with the technological realities is that from a political perspective, the presence of the technological system almost entirely eliminates the reality of real political choices because you have no choice but to address the tank question. Now, that is, and this is why I'm an advocate for parallelism, but even within parallelism, you have to recognize that you can't just simply say no, that you have to grapple with the sense of technology. So you have to be able to say, well, we're going to have a more thoughtful interaction with technology. But even if we set up a parallel Christian society, Christian community, that's really focused on organic culture, that's focused on rules and a way of life that emerge out of the life of the community that are held in the hand of the community, we still have to grapple with the tanks that our neighbors had, you know, like Joe Biden saying, well, I've got, you know, you have to deal with my F-16s and I can just bomb you to, you know,
and he's
not wrong because that's a problem. So you have to then say, well, how is it that then we approach technology in such a way that we don't buy into the inherent, what we might call soteriology of technology, in a sense that the progression of technical advancement, as long as it continues, we will eventually arrive at a kind of nirvana utopian state. So is there a way for us to reject the utopianism of technology and to reground it in a way that gives us to subordinate it to the cultural ethos of a community, to say that we recognize that we just, it's a sinful world. And in a sinful world, we have to grapple with the realities of a sinful world, that people will now use this technology to obtain power and money. And if we want to create a healthy relationship with technology, it's the same thing with violence, right? That if we want to establish a parallel community and we're successful at it, that becomes a threat to the state. And all nations, all communities, if you want to survive, they're ultimately in a sinful world founded on violence. There's no way to escape that reality. And so you might have your beautiful parallel Christian community, but like say, take for example, the Amish. The only reason why the Amish exist is that they're not a threat to the current state. And so the state allows them to the peace of thing. But the Amish's ability to live peacefully and to conduct their life the way that they do in an 18th, 17th century way is built on the violence of the American state. And they're protected by the weapons of the American state. And just because the American state doesn't see them as a threat, they're not stomped on. And so there, you know, so we have to recognize that there's these realities. And this is something that Alul talks about, what he talks about, this idea of necessity. In a sinful world, there are some things that your choices are not always between what is right and wrong, but between the lesser and greater evil. So having tanks or means to stopping tanks may introduce into our community certain ills that we really don't want, but we have no choice but to introduce tanks. So the question is what are the ways that we can introduce tanks into our society that will ground them as much as possible organically into the culture of our community and subordinate them to that culture, where we're not being told by the demands of the technology itself that this is how we must conduct ourselves, but that we can, in a sense, have tanks and subordinate them to the culture of the community. I know it's kind of a fuzzy sort of thing. And I, you know, because I, like you say, I live in this technical reality like everybody else. This is all kind of new, but we have to grapple with the reality that we can't get outside the technological system in that sense, that we have to, even if we carve out a bubble for ourselves within the society, its demands will force itself upon us and limit our choices. So that's, I guess, kind of the way to start thinking about how do we relate to technology in a new way that doesn't take on the kind of utopianism that is inherent in technology. And I just maybe just give me for a second. Well, and you people say, well, the utopian in technology. I'll say, well, think about the idea of how the church change process goes to bring it back to people in the churches, right? So we've got an older church, kind of stable. People in the church realize we need to get the gospel out. So they go down, they see this technology. There's this great system. You know, we're going to change our music style. We're going to change it. So what happens? People pick up these pieces of solutions from other churches, and then they bring them into the church and they're going to implement them. And the problem now becomes, how do you get buy-in from the community for the change process, right? And so what's happening is, then you're promising these people a utopian situation. So there is this glorious future of the grand, vibrant church that we could be, the sort of the utopian future that we have for our congregation, which is this successful, vibrant congregation. And now what we need to do is to undergo a revolution in our church. And through the revolution, when we arrive on the other side, we'll have this kind of church utopia. And the price that to pay, so because of the nobleness of the goal, if I force out certain malcontents who don't want to change, well, that's the price that I must pay to reach church nirvana. And that's really what we're undergoing when we talk about this church change process with, you know, becoming more of like a seeker church or an outreach church or a growth-minded or whatever, is that we're really forcing a lot of these old congregations to, it's basically kind of a revolution within the church towards a new technical reality. And so that's kind of when you take that, so what you're looking at in terms of building a community is how do we then relate to technology without this revolutionary process and without trying to achieve this glorious new future? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And it's funny that before I was exposed to some of, before I listened to the podcast on Jacques Ellul and really started reading about the technological society. I mean, I already was like, it's very similar to some of like the managerial revolution stuff.
It very so is.
I was fooling around with that a little bit, and I wrote a paper. I haven't actually given it or published it anywhere else, but it was to this small Lutheran colloquy in Wisconsin and last year. And I talk about like lessons from the woke movement, how it just kind of took over so many churches and why was this? And so I talk about, you have your managers, you have your activists, you have your therapists running these churches, but really what you need is a pastor. And all of these other, I guess, technicians, they had ways of dealing with this problem that were a little different, but they were all compromised in some way. And so then the pastor or the shepherd is sort of the model that I said, like, oh, this is the only solution I see. And, you know, basically, I didn't realize it at the time, but I was advocating casting off some technology, I guess. So like one of the things was that seminaries are problems, basically.
Like, they are. Unfortunately, they are.
They're like, you know, not, I'm not saying like it's innately evil to go to a place and study, but like you look at everything in that process has a very high cost to it. So like you upend the roots of your family and go, you know, oftentimes halfway around the country or maybe to another country to learn about the Bible. Now, some people can handle that. Sometimes that works out. But like you think about, you're doing this on a mass scale. You're disconnecting people from their accountability structures. And now they're not even with real people who, and when I say real people, I mean people from every age bracket and the kinds of people that they'll be ministering to after seminary. You put them in this artificial environment where, as you said earlier, their friends are other students pursuing a master's, and then professors who, you know, frankly, a lot of them aren't even pastors themselves.
Well, and they're forced to grapple with the deep questions, the most troubling, you know, critiques of the Christian faith as well, too. So a lot of times you go in there and their faith is actually being undermined with the most challenging questions of philosophy and theology.
You know, and a lot of them get an academic mindset that makes them incapable, or it's not as attractive to them anymore to actually minister to real people. They think it's much more important because the big thing is like, you know, some hotshot apologist or theologian or, you know, that's who they're looking up to and they want to be like that. So they end up like, well, I'm not going to be a pastor anymore. Right.
Well, or you complexify the life of your things. Like we have to come in and challenge the existing worldview because that's what they did for me in seminary. So now I've got to go out and challenge the worldview of the people in the pews.
Oh my goodness. Yes.
So you go in and your whole purpose is to undermine the faith of your community.
You're giving me flashbacks because I remember sitting in class.
Don't break out in hives or whatever. That's fine. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember like the professor saying like, you know, should we apologize for the Holocaust as Christians and this kind of thing? And like, there seemed to be general agreement that we should in the class. And I'm like looking around like, what? But I remember one of the students was like, you know, I'm going to go back to it was like in Mississippi or something, you know, this traditional church. I'm going to go back to my church. And I'm going to tell them this is during remember the kneeling controversy? I'm going to tell my church, I watch the NFL. And, you know, they're the ones that are being legalistic because they won't watch, they're boycotting the NFL because they love America and all this. And I'm like, what are you thinking? This is so outside, but they thought it was within the scope of being a pastor now because, you know, yeah, like they had learned this in seminary and now they're going to go teach the hayseeds back home what real theology is and what real morality is. And so anyway, the seminaries are a problem. That's one of the things that I just identified is like a lot of this nonsense. Actually, it began there. It began with systems imposed on churches from people who were who went to seminary and learned to be technicians. And yeah, the shepherd is someone who arises, I think, organically from within the body, more likely. That's a better way to find your pastor. It's like you've grown, like he's been there for some time. You preferably someone who grew up there. That's not always possible, you know, but someone you know who's loves your people, because you got to love the sheep. They're your sheep. There's like a relationship, an ownership, in a way, like a responsibility and obligation. And then you equip them with these tools that they may need. Like they need to understand some church history. They need to understand what the Bible says and how to read it in its languages and these, but you don't upend their lives and go give them a system. Like they're still within the body, working among the body as they're learning these things. So that was kind of my solution. And then the scale thing too, to focus on smaller units, like smaller churches, because it seems to me that the technology we're talking about, it's much more challenged on a small scale. Like if you're pastor who goes into a church with 100 people, they're not going to put up with your innovations. Whereas if it's a CEO, basically, you know, a mega church pastor with a board, what are you going to do? There's 10,000 people.
You need technology to run at that scale.
You have to. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause that's the thing that the technology gives you, is the power to scale things up and to scale society up. So yeah, that's one of the first things. I guess that's, you know, might you say, what can you do about it? Well, is to descale society. But again, it comes down to it. Like I remember I had to deal with a lot of anger myself with my own seminary, because it took me a long time to figure out why was I kind of mad at my own seminary, because I got a world-class education at my seminary. You know, I speak two classical languages, a bit of a third, I know theology, you know, and so forth, right? We got a first class biblical theological education, but it left me spiritually destitute. And I realized in hindsight, what I was actually hoping for is that somebody would have put their arm around me and led me up the mountain. And so I think there is a sense of separating from the people can be a good thing, like the way that Moses did, the way that Abraham did, the way that Paul did on the road to Damascus. But they separate you and said, you know, come pray with me. Together we are going to go and meet God. And my sense of it is far, far more important for our spiritual leaders is that they have a real deep foundation, that they have gone through that process of going up the mountain. They've been tested by God and they've met God. And, you know, they've had that here am I moment, you know, and the Lord has put their stamp of approval. Now they go back down the mountain and, you know, they go and make disciples in their own congregation. So they're in a sense of come pray with me and together we will meet God. And to me, that's really what is far more necessary. Now, all of the rest of the stuff, like teaching people how to read the scriptures and things, there's value in, you know, critical methodologies and so forth. But there isn't a methodology in the world out there that can guarantee you're going to arrive at the right meaning of scripture anyways. You know, that's sort of one of the lessons of postmodernism. So, in my mind, you're far better off. I think you're better off with a pastor who has met God than with one who is a technician of the word.
And I want to clarify, because I don't know if even we're on the same page on this, but what I think you were just saying, you know, there's not a methodology that can guarantee is that, so like the grammatical, historical, hermeneutic, right, which is what most conservatives, they advocate. This is what I think it boils down to. The argument for using that is that it's inescapable. Like it's just kind of sewn into the fabric of reality that words have to mean something. That's really what I think that's saying. And so when you apply this logic to a text to try to ascertain its meaning, like there's some good tool, like understanding the context, understanding something about the audience and the authorial intent, all these things really do help you, I think, understand the meaning, but
they don't guarantee that you're going to uncover it.
Maybe I'll have you unpack that then, because what I think of when you say that is like without knowing God, without this, you called it a mystical component earlier, like you could have someone who doesn't even know Christ, hasn't even been born again, who's trying to like apply these methods. Like they could apply it just as well as could apply it.
Basically, you're looking at German New Testament scholarship.
That's
basically the essence of German New Testament scholarship.
It's just technical. And it has to be more than that.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's actually kind of a bigger thing. So my undergraduate degree is in philosophy and specifically in hermeneutics. So, you know, the theory of how meaning transfers, right? So my touchstone in that regard would be Hans-Georg Gadamer's Truth and Method. And Gadamer was a figure who tried to walk between the modernists and the postmodernists to say that the postmoderns have a valid criticism of modernism and, you know, hermeneutical methodology, that you cannot guarantee the correct interpretation with method. But Gadamer also then recognized that the modernists really dismissed the role of the interpreter. So there's this notion that words and their meanings are separate. So for example, let's take a simple word like dog. You have a loving relationship with your dog. You've had a pet that you grew up with. You know, you can have the sights, the smells, the sounds, the memory. When I say the word dog, it evokes all of these positive memories.
Sure.
I got bit by a dog. I was jumped on and attacked. And so every time you say the word dog, it provokes a very, very different type of response that way for me. We both are using the same word, but they both have two very, very different meanings. So, you know, what Gadamer tries to do is walk between, he says that there is a reality that word has an intended meaning, but once you speak it, it becomes a thing of its own and the hearer will hear it from their own subjectivity that he can't escape from. So he walks like there. I mean, we could probably do 5 episodes on just on Gadamer alone. So I'm sorry for like sidetracking.
I've actually been pretty critical of Gadamer in the past, just because, I mean, I think there is, like, objectively speaking, there is such a thing as a dog, like whether you or I, we may have,
but you always meet the dog differently at different. So some, the being of the dog will unfold itself differently to you at different moments. So in a sense, and this is what
that's because we're limited, in order, though,
what's right? that? Sorry.
That's because we're limited. We're finite beings.
That's right. And that's basically what he argues.
I'm talking about like in an objective, when I think of objective, like from the, like God knows what a dog is, right?
Yes, that would be it. And that's one thing that Gadamer notes. He says, you know, that if you stand outside of time and history, and he says, really only God is in that place. And it's just sort of one of these little throwaway lines. For God, there is objectivity, but for the rest of us, there is such a thing as truth, but our apprehension of it is always partial and limited because we cannot know the fullness of the being of anything in that regard. So it just creates a kind of humility towards meaning.
Wouldn't that, and I'm trying to, so wouldn't that, ultimately lead though to a rank skepticism where,
or relativism, so, and
well, yeah, because I do believe in like a certain kind of epistemological humility, just in the fact that we are limited and we just have to admit that kind of from the gate. But at the same time, there is a created order, and that God can communicate to us in such a way that we know things. I think even the experience you're talking about, where you have that face to face on the mountain moment, God is doing something to us that you can't deny it. Like, that was God. I heard it. I saw it. I felt it, whatever, you know, I experienced it in, even in the text of Scripture, the Holy Spirit does this, where we do know certain things.
That's right. This gets us a little farther. No, this gets us farther afield, to sort of what we would call the crisis of authority. Right. So,
Just so the audience knows, we're not talking about technology anymore.
No, we're a long way from Kansas now, Dorothy. So we're talking in a sense of the crisis of authority. So where does authority? So one of, and it does relate though, because one of the things that the Enlightenment did in, you know, when you get the Kantian sort of thing, is that there was this severing between what we might call the metaphysical realities, and, you know, they wanted sure knowledge. And so they looked at things like the Platonic forms, metaphysical knowledge, the revelation of God. And they said, well, you can't prove God. You just have to basically assume that God is there. You can't prove him. You assume it a priori. So what Kant argued is that there's no content to be learned in the forms. And what ends up happening with this split with Kant between the metaphysical and the, what we might call the physical, the material, is that in this new scientific rational world, people basically then shifted from the question of what does it mean and how, what should I do, to how does it work? And this answering the question of how does it work is tremendously powerful. So the basic utilitarian question. So the sense of, if it works, if it's efficient, it must therefore be good, right? Because we don't test anything according to the metaphysical realities. But what this did invariably is it created a crisis of authority. Because what happened is that the scientist was saying, if we look at things empirically, we can establish sure knowledge. And what Gadamer critiqued, and this is the value of the postmoderns, is that they said, no, you can't actually ever come up with sure knowledge. So in the end, you never get away from the problem of how do you decide ultimately in the end what is true, what does it mean, and what should we do? So we've gone back to, well, we have substitutes now. Well, oh, if you went to Harvard, you must be an expert. You can tell us what to do. Well, COVID really exposed the fallacy of that. So now we have this crisis in our society where authority is seen as inherently authoritarian, The expert class has been completely discredited. The old form of science has been shown that it cannot provide sure knowledge. So where do we find the answer? And so now you have to, in a sense, go back to the older things. And ultimately, really the only solution is that when you look at even say something like a biblical text, well, what does the scripture rely on? Is the belief that Moses, Abraham, and figure people like Paul actually met God, and that Jesus himself actually was God, and that in so doing, they are revealing this intuitive mystical. So they had direct theophanies, God spoke to them, they told, and they relayed that to us. So ultimately, it comes down to a sense of, is there a person in your community that you then can trust to say in the crisis, what does this mean? I'm reading this in scripture. What does this really mean? Or what should I do with this? Should I take this new job? Should I get married to this woman? All of these types of questions we have, you know, when they're telling me to mask up and take this injection, pastor, what should we do? Or maybe it's not a pastor, maybe it's somebody else. But it really comes down to, in the end, trusting that this person in the moment makes wise judgments. So this goes back to the older biblical wisdom literature, and this is an example. So for those that have heard me before, I apologize, but I bring up this example again and again because it really centers it. Proverbs 26, verse 4 and 5, right? So in the first verse, it says, do not correct a fool or you will be drawn into his folly. And then in the very next verse, it says, correct a fool or he will ever remain bound up in his folly. And you're thinking, if you think of like the scripture as like God's guidebook for living, you have completely two opposite advice, you know, bits of advice on back-to-back verses. So what do you do with that? How do you want to? It took me forever to realize that, yeah. Wait a minute, the truth of it is in between it. It's actually telling you the nature of wisdom is that you live before the face of God, you go up the mountain like Abraham and you meet God. Then in the moment when you encounter the fool, you will know what the right thing to do is. It's like Solomon who, and meeting the two mothers battling over the baby and says, well, cut the baby in half. Well, you can't, how do you write a policy manual that says, you know, the proper procedure for knowing when to cut off a baby in half? You can't do it. And so really it comes back down to nurturing people in our society who have a direct encounter with God. And so even with our pastors, there is this sense that even if they don't participate in a direct theophany, we talk about an archetype, that your pastor is participating in the archetype of revelation when they're dealing with scripture, such that when they come up on the pulpit, they are not just a technician of the word, but they're actually participating in the act of revealing God to you from the pulpit, right, in the archetype of revelation. Even in a small way.
Question.
Does that
for
make
you.
Sense?
I
know we're like way far afield.
Yeah,
here.
And that's fine. If you enjoy intellectually stimulating conversations like this, because I don't always do podcasts like this, let me know in the comments. Because I see this more and more. Discussions that we're having Joe Rogan's having discussions.
Oh, he's doing the same thing. Yeah.
The big podcasts are doing this where they're challenging things that we've always assumed and going back and forth. And there seems to be a humble disposition about it to like, well, let me consider what you're saying. And I think it's because of what you just said that we've lost faith in science to arrive at like the correct answers every
yes.
time, or scientists.
The experts don't have
the
them
experts,
either.
Right. So the question I guess I'd have, I suppose this might be an objection, I'm not sure, but
sure.
I have this feeling that this would destroy what you're saying would undermine the created order for this reason. When the postmodernists say they're not sure about we can't be sure, I mean, they seem awfully sure, right, that we can't be sure. So there seems to be this inescapability that there are certain things that like are grounded in the way God designed us. Like we don't have to have an argument for it necessarily. Like there doesn't need to be a scientific process that brings this truth to us. We just know it because that's how we were designed to function. God gave it to us, and he did not just give it to Christians. There's people who are not Christians who, like for example, Romans 1, they have a moral law They know that they're in violation of it, right? So I just think that there are some things we can be certain about, but that we cannot be certain that the scientific process will necessarily bring truth to us, because it's based on circumstance and its own philosophical preconditions and assumptions and so forth. So is that fair? Is that,
yeah,
are we on the same page, or are we disagreeing?
Yes, because this is that, the sense, the foundation is, and this is basically what the Proverbs are about. So there is a created order, a moral order, what we might call, you know, for those that are more philosophical, the forms, right? So God has written, and he talks about this in the various Proverbs, you know, in terms of weaving wisdom into the whole fabric of creation. So, and I would argue that there's a process between, like, the kind of coming together, and this is maybe a God, but there's a sense where you see the world correctly. And this is why you, in a sense, you need that divine guidance. Because going up the mountain allows you this process of, you know, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. So you stand before the presence of God, and then, like Abraham, this is that whole in Genesis, the passage when he goes up with the sacrifice of Isaac, is what Abraham is gaining on that mountain is his ability to see correctly. And there's a whole, right, which once you get into the Hebrew, it's most of the translations allied the thing, because they're some misunderstood words. This is why we do word studies, right? The idea is that in the encounter with God, you gain your sight. And in so gaining sight and wisdom, it allows you to see the order that is woven into creation. So that way, like the Proverbs and the writer of Proverbs, you can see correctly the situation as it lies in the moment of life, and you can create generalities and so forth. And there's almost a kind of a scientific process, but at the same time, it really comes to you from a sort of, in a sense, it's hierarchical, because flows from God.
Like you know a dog better when you have lived longer and had more experiences with dogs, whether good or bad, you get to know the essence of, okay, this is what a dog is.
But,
is that what
yes,
you're saying?
But also okay. Then the greater meaning and significance of the dog also is enhanced if you live in before the face of God with in that sort of intimate encounter, that intimate mystical encounter with God. So because you the fear of the Lord is begin. So your relationship with God allows you to see the importance, the essence, and the meaning of the dog that's inherent in the dog. So it also allows you to see more correctly the archetypes, the rules, the patterns that are buried in society. So you see more correctly the archetype of the good king. And so it allows you to see whether your king is a good king or not, because you can see whether he conforms or not to God's pattern of kingship. Hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
it's that living before God that allows you. And that pattern for kingship is woven into the creation. So you know that he's a good king because he conforms. But how do you come to see it, right? Well, you know, people say, well, these truths we hold as self-evident. They're not really self-evident. They're learned by being before the face of God, or they're learned from the culture. Again, we talked about that culture of the stable, right? Well, everything that happens in that stable is self-evident to somebody who's grown up in the culture of the stable. So somebody who grows up in a Christian culture, informed by Christian truths, who lives close to God, all of these realities are self-evident to them. The meaning of the kingship, the meaning of the pastorate, the meaning of marriage, the meaning of sexual morality, they're all obvious to them because the culture of the stable is just ingrained into them. And so because of that, it's all self-evident to them. But it really, in a sense, it's only self-evident because they're immersed in this reality of culture that lives before God, that is in touch with the created order. And that's kind of really the ideal, but that's really, I think, in a sinful world, that's sort of the best that we do.
So can I bring it sort of full circle, and then I'll give you the final word here. So we started off talking about technology, and I think that this actually relates, and we've just kind of
come to the
circle, because this is what you're describing. Wisdom is what you're describing. Wisdom that comes with experience, age, and ultimately, for Christians, this comes with knowing God. This is not something that you can replicate in an abstract form with systematic theology or at a seminary and the various church growth strategies and so forth. You can't get what you're talking about and what the Bible talks about. It doesn't, it's not copied. Like you could, you know, put it in a copy machine like you would a paper and get replicated 1,000 times. And so that you can pick up a pastor at the seminary factory or the pastor factory.
Seminary factory. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. yeah. Seminary. Yeah. Don't, that would give me real nightmares if there's a seminary factory. So these systems though, do not give us that. And that's one of the things that we've kind of lost. We've lost the value of that because now mm-hmm. we value systems and we don't prize wisdom. We prize knowledge. We prize, as you, I think, said.
I'm glad that you hit that, John, because that's the real contrast. Like, you know, that sense of knowledge is power versus like, well, what do you have with wisdom? You don't have anything, right?
Yeah.
And I think that sort of nails it, that contrast between wisdom and knowledge.
Right. Right. And we live in a society that prizes knowledge, and the experts are the, you know, young whippersnappers even sometimes, and sometimes there is wisdom in young people. I'm not saying there's not all, but it's people who have studied in the university rather than, I mean, I saw this is just a corporate problem. I saw this when I worked for a big company. It's like, you know, we were all furniture technicians and we're like, we understand how this works. And then you get some, you know, bean counter who comes in to manage the place and, you know, it wants to only be there as short a time as possible so they can climb the next rung and move to some, you know, some other place or that they have no roots and, you know, get that corporate job. But they can't run the place because they don't understand. They don't have the wisdom. They have the knowledge that came with going to school. They don't have the wisdom. And that's what I think, that's what we're talking about with technology. Technology brings a blessing. It can teach some things, but there's a curse. Wisdom is, I think, the casualty oftentimes. So that's my kind of cap on what we've been talking about. And also, I think the application is built into that we need to change kind of the way we value things, to value wisdom. Mm-hmm. And to just be self-aware of the way that technologies and systems can negatively influence us. So I'll give you the final word on how you want to land the plane. And
I think it underlies for me what I've realized is a significant hole in the life of the church. We do a lot of church growth, church building, and so forth, educating even, but we don't really make disciples. So if we think about the discipling process to bring it back to that stable yard or, you know, the blacksmith shop or the furniture maker shop, and think about apprenticing in terms of that kind of organic apprentice where you're learning the job on the hand, you're interiorizing all of things, and think about what Jesus did with his disciples, and you look at the Gospels, right, and you read the Gospels through with an eye to like an apprenticeship process. Jesus was teaching them how to have faith. You know, you feed them, right? You know, these little throwaway lines in the feeding of the 5,000, you feed them, uh-huh. right? And the disciples are completely flummoxed. And then he shows them, you know, why did you doubt? You know, Peter, I told you to walk to me on the water. And then you start to see that, like, why did you doubt? And so as he goes through, little by little, he's teaching these men, discipling them. And he says to them, go and do likewise. So what we're really, church is about bringing people into the stable, and maybe not everyone becomes a stable master, but they all can become competent stable hands who can then teach the next generation of stable hands. And the knowledge is embedded, it's intuitive, and that's really what, so we're teaching people how to pray, how to worship, how to live, and we're doing it in an environment that, again, is cognizant of this understanding of wisdom, and that much of what we do is held in the communal memory of us as a people, and we're passing that on. It has maybe a bit of a boot camp experience. It has a bit of maybe training camp, like you would have two-a-days with football kind of thing, but you're forging relationships, you're forging a culture, and you're bringing people in. And that's really, in a sense, the heart of Christian community, as opposed to the technical reality of what we're doing. So I think you can create a picture for people of this alternate reality, but that's really the world that the technical society wants to deny us, because it wants to take that reality, abstract it, rationalize it, and turn it into a system that can be, then be replicated and produce consistent results. And we need to say that, no, the thing that we, that thing that you want to replicate and rationalize, this is the thing that is most important for us to hang on to, especially for us as a Christian community.
Well said. Well said. Well, if people want to follow Kryptos, they can go to @_Kryptos on X, formerly known as Twitter. And they can go to seekingthehiddenthing.com. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be on, John.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. God bless.
This is the place where Black is the main character, where we dive into something new like the latest season of Vim, The Scare, and the award-winning American Fiction. Or add to the experience by buying or renting the biopic of a legend, Bob Marley, One Love. And add on channels like Paramount Plus and Stars to bask in nostalgia with Beverly Hills Cop and BMF. Explore Prime Video's culture-rated collection and enjoy old-school greats and new-school hits. Restrictions apply. See Amazon.com/Amazon Prime for details.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.